With David Hyde, I'm Steve Scherr. This is The Record on KUOW. We turn now to Crimea and the Ukraine. Russian forces have occupied the mostly Russian-speaking peninsula on the Black Sea. Crimea is a long day's drive down the Dnieper River from Ukraine's capital city. Secretary of State John Kerry is heading to Kiev today. We're likely to hear much more about Crimea and the nearly 2 million people who live there, as well as broader Ukraine. So we wanted to take a moment to get to know the history and the geopolitics of the area. For more on that, we're joined by The World's Chris Wolf. Hello, Chris.
Hi.
Crimea is mostly Russian-speaking. Why is that?
It's historic. The area was conquered by the Russian Empire in the 18th century and colonized at that time with a mix of people from all over the Russian Empire, but predominantly Russian. So that's why today you'll find most people there still speaking Russian.
The Russians were finishing a war with a very powerful Muslim state. They defeated the Crimean Tatars. Is there any religious background to this conflict?
Not to this conflict, no. The Crimean Tatars are, there's a few, most of them were driven out a couple of hundred years ago. There's a few still there. They've survived various persecutions, most recently under Stalin, and they are out now with some of the ethnic Ukrainians in Crimea protesting the Russian takeover. They'd rather be part of Ukraine. But they're not particularly religious, apparently, and they're not that keen on making this a religious conflict. They're a very small minority in what's really a conflict between Ukrainians and Russians.
The Crimea is an outlet to the sea, so Russia already controls 400 miles of Black Sea coastline. From a strategic standpoint, why would they need the Crimean Peninsula?
They control a lot of coastline, but as you may have seen the images of Sochi, it's kind of mountainous, not very good harbors. If you want a harbor to put a naval base in, you want Sevastopol, the big city in Crimea. And that's one of the reasons that the Russians always strove to try and take over this part of the world, to give themselves an outlet to the sea. You got to remember, for most of its history, Russia was a landlocked, poor, isolated country that saw themselves as marginalized, without access to markets, without the ability to project its power on the world stage like a sea power can, like the United States and Britain have historically. So their breaking through into the Crimea was a real kind of coming out for Russia as a great power. It's one of the reasons why Crimea is so symbolically important to Russians.
What's the relationship, what's the historic relationship between Russian-speaking peoples and Ukrainians?
That's a really complicated question, because for the last couple of hundred years, the Russia and then the Soviet Union has kind of spun a series of myths that historians have been trying to unravel in the last 20 years, that they're all descended from the one people, the Kievan Rus of like the 9th century AD, and that somehow they've managed to diverge a little bit so that, you know, Russians will look at Belarusians and Ukrainians as, they call them either the White Russians or the Little Russians, whereas they look at themselves as the Great Russians. But basically, they're all the same people with a very similar language and common interests. But in fact, that's not really the case. That's kind of a myth that's been projected. The area of the heartland of Ukraine was for long its own state, and it's had its own interests. And it's only since like the 17th century that they've been pulled into the Russian orbit, and this myth has been projected that still a lot of people still believe. Even today, I was arguing with one of my producers about what it is to be Ukrainian.
But Ukraine has a long history. Why would there be an argument about that? Only in relation
Putin
to Russia.
Apparently told George W. Bush in 2008, Ukraine is not a real country.
Yeah.
This is one of the core issues here, that there's not a kind of basic respect for Ukraine as an entity. It's just seen as a province of Russia, as the way one expert put it to me recently, that's by an accident of history has gone its own way. So we're looking at some real problems here. We don't really know what's in Putin's mind. On the one hand, he could be just wanting to genuinely protect Russian-speaking people in eastern and southern Ukraine. On the other hand, you've got to think that the Ukrainian Revolution was a revolution against tyranny and corruption. And there are plenty of people in Russia who sympathize with that. In fact, several hundred people were arrested in Moscow just last week protesting, pro-democracy protesters. And you've got to imagine that, we don't know this, but on one level, Putin could see the Ukrainian revolution as an existential threat. He may want to go all the way to Kiev. I think that's unlikely. I think he's probably going to see enough international opposition to think he'll probably try and just slice off what he can, get some kind of de facto partition like he had successfully done in Moldova in the 1990s and then in Georgia, the Republic of Georgia, in as recently as 2008.
Carving off much of the Russian-speaking part of the Ukraine?
Yes. I mean, you have to think about what this region means to Russia, its kind of historic importance for it to not want to lose it and not want to lose. I think Russia's leaders have convinced themselves that they can't give up Crimea without forfeiting Russia's status as a great power, a naval power able to reach out into the world. And they, if they want to hang on to Crimea, it would be logical that they would want to hang on to the land that joins Crimea to Russia. You can't get to Crimea without passing through Ukraine by land. There's a ferry to the east, but you really need, if you wanted to get to it, you'd have to go by land. So my concern is that we haven't seen the end of this yet, particularly with pro-Russian protesters taking over town halls in some cities in the east today.
And Chris Wolf, the U.S. is under pressure from senators, from the world. The EU is under pressure. How much can the U.S. and the Europeans do to stop Putin?
They can take various diplomatic steps. They can probably issue some sanctions for a while, like they did after the invasion of Georgia in 2008. But I don't think many people noticed them at the time. The Russians certainly weren't that worried about it, knowing that in time Russia is too important as a trading partner for those to stick. So I think there'll be a lot of huffing and puffing, but I don't think it's going to amount to anything. I don't think your listeners have to worry too much about an escalation. There could be a conflict. The Ukrainians are proud people, but they know they have no money. They know they have no army to speak of that can stand up to the Russians, and you don't win a war with like national stereotypes of stubbornness and strength.
Chris Wolf, he's news editor at The World from Public Radio International. Chris, thanks for talking to us.
You're welcome.
We'll continue to track what's happening in Ukraine and get some background as well as the record and as KUOW continues to look at what's happening.